Now, we're going to chat about male baldness and just going bald and the emotional impact that that can have on men. Chris Wasser has written a great article about how it affected him, and he's with me in studio to chat about it. Chris, thanks so much for coming in. You know, it's a vulnerable topic, and you know, to open up about it and to share your story and your experience, and undoubtedly it'll help other people, you know, is brave, some might say, but also, you know, so important. So can you take us back maybe to the first time that you may have noticed signs of baldness?
Yeah, thanks a million for having me on, Anna. Yeah, I think the first time was I had just come back from a few days away with some friends, and one of the guys posted a photograph of me on Facebook. So I was about 22, probably about 22 at the time, if not like just almost 22.
Very young, yeah.
And there was one group shot where I just thought something doesn't look right there. And what I meant was I zoomed in and it looked as though someone had taken like a pencil eraser to like the right side of my scalp and it just started, you know, lightly, you know, rubbing out my hair basically. And I thought, is that a problem? Like, so I checked in the mirror and I immediately just panic stations, just thought, what's going on here? Because that's the strange thing about losing your hair. You don't notice it at the start. It's already happening to you by the time, you know,
That was the first time.
Yeah. I remember standing in front of the mirror there in the old family house and just panicking. And then that was all I thought about when I was going to sleep that night. And then it kind of went away because I think I thought the problem would go away. Mm-hmm. So that's the funniest thing about hair loss is you genuinely don't think it's going to happen to you, despite the fact that I do come from a long line of baldies. Mm-hmm. And then the second funniest thing is that you think that you will be the only person in the world where it just stops magically by itself. Yeah. And it didn't. So basically, I always used to say that the grass stopped growing on the right side of my head. Mm-hmm. And that was a problem for me because my hair fell to the left. So I started to try and force my hair over the other way, which I'm sure maybe it's like, you know, I was giving people a mirror image of myself and I didn't like doing that, but I had already started to essentially comb it over. I remember then people started making jokes because, you know, family and friends could actually see it. And it was, you know, almost acceptable in air quotes to, you know, crack jokes about that. No one ever said to me, oh, does that bother you?
Yeah, are you okay?
Yeah, because it really did. And I remember then a trip to the barber's. And it was a barber's in Stephen's Green that I hadn't gone to before. And I remember them saying, the person cutting my hair asked me if I had burnt my hair recently. And I remember thinking, what exactly does she mean by that? And it was because my hair was so thin on top.
And do you think that was because you were so young that they weren't putting two and two together and thinking, well, actually this could be a condition?
Yeah. Like that there's no way like that this guy in his early 20s maybe could, you know. And I thought it was so strange myself, but I knew exactly what they were talking about. So it became a big problem very quickly. It became something I was quite self-conscious about. I started to do everything I could to hide it. My morning preparation was just, it was just a nightmare. I think I'd spend about 20 minutes to half an hour every morning preparing my hair in a way that I would feel, you know, confident and comfortable about for the rest of the day. And I worked out that's like nearly 3 hours a week, just kind of pushing the same sorry rock up the same steep hill. And it just really, really gets to you. And it affected my confidence. It affected my stance. I remember I would kind of, it's almost as if I tried to hide in my own body and I just kind of hunch over and I didn't want anyone to see it. And I'd wear hats all the time just to kind of cover it up. Hated sitting in areas and restaurants where you'd be like directly under a light and that would just draw attention to it. Hated having my hair cut. Despise changing rooms in clothes shops because there's nobody else obviously in there in the change room with you, but you cannot avoid change rooms. Are the worst. They just highlight
all
the worst
problems. For everybody. Yeah. Nobody likes the lighting and the mirrors that come with changing rooms.
No, and every time I looked into the mirror, I was just like, there it is. There is my problem. And I think at one stage, then the family intervention was required, and that was the first time that I shaved my head.
Before we get to the shaving the head, because that's a very significant part of your story.
Yeah.
Some people listening, maybe people that have experienced baldness and maybe some that haven't, might say, well, what's the big deal? Like, why did it matter so much to you?
I mean, the short answer is I don't know. I remember thinking at the time, and I think this problem still exists that, you know, baldness is sometimes equated to ugliness. And I kind of worried that that was it, you know, in terms of dating, in terms of how I look, just my social life is over. I'm going to look ridiculous. And I feel I don't feel good about myself saying that and, mm-hmm. and admitting that I thought that, because as I said, I come from a long line of baldies, and that, you know, am I kind of criticizing my dad's look or his dad before him? I'm not. I just, at the time, I just thought, I don't want, you know, to lose my hair. And I think as well, I used to think that my hair kind of defined me and it was all part of my identity, because as a teenager, I dyed it every color and
really?
I grew it every, I mean, like my hair changed depending on, you know, the films or the shows that I was watching or the music that I was listening mm-hmm. to. So at one
and
point,
for many people, they do that depending on where they are in their life, their hair reflects that.
Absolutely. I mean, you can change your outfits all you like, but the hair is mm-hmm. the kind of, you know, the at the time I thought the central characteristic of who you are. And I used to, I just loved having hair, basically.
So for you then, going from being in a place where it affected your confidence, you know, you hated being in certain situations, to then deciding at 25, this is it, I'm shaving it off. How did you get to that point, and what was that day like for you?
With great difficulty. That's how I got to that point. Mm-hmm. I remember my aunt, Angela, she's a former hairdresser, and there were a group of us in my parents' house, and she had the trimmers with us, with her. Don't know why, maybe this was planned in advance. And I had agreed to a haircut, but I don't remember agreeing to like a shave. But then once I sat there and I had the cloak on me, I just thought, okay, go for it.
Really?
And again, another thing was that I had seen a photograph earlier in the day, and I thought, I really have lost this battle. Mm-hmm. And actually, wouldn't it be easier to just get rid of the whole thing? And then you're not worrying about losing it anymore. You're taking control of it in a way, mm-hmm. and you're deciding, this is how I'm going to look. I remember the first time I saw myself, I did cry. I did get, you know, a little bit annoyed. But I did, because it was like the person staring back at me, it was like, who's that? You know, I tried to imagine what that might look like, and I was a bit upset about it. I think what was worse was that I came back into Dublin that night, went to a gig in the Olympia Theatre, and I remember the first time a person called me baldy was outside the Olympia Theatre in Dublin, and it was a scalper, the irony is not lost on me there, trying to sell me a ticket, or buying or selling baldy, that's what he said. And I
How did that feel?
I can't even tell you what gig that was. Or what back, but I remember that because I think I spent like the next 2 hours, and I was probably reviewing that gig at the time. So I'd love to see what that article looks like, because for the 2 hours I was not paying attention mm-hmm. to the band. I was paying attention to the fact that this is me now. I'm baldy, and I hated that.
How did you learn to cope with those kind of comments, not just from strangers, but from friends and family?
You get used to it. There were a lot of jokes from friends and family. There still are, you know, some comments from family every now and then, and some friends, and you know, you do get used to them and you do shrug them off depending on what kind of day you have. I mean, I think that's fair enough too. That
should you have to shrug them off though?
I don't think you should, because imagine if you were to make a comment based on, you know, someone else's appearance. I would never comment on someone else's appearance, or imagine saying something about their weight or saying something about their face, or you know.
And people do all the time, whether
really
somebody
do.
Has lost weight, put on weight, they've changed something about themselves. It's almost like we can't help but comment on somebody's appearance.
Oh, yeah.
We have idea what they're going through.
So judgy. And that's all. Like, I mean, it's so weird that like another person can say those things and they won't put any thought into the fact that that might cut the other person a little bit. You know, it does go deep. But at the time, when I first shaved my head, there were an awful lot of jokes because, you know, it was a different look.
And you were young.
I was young. And I sort of got used to it, but also sort of enjoyed the look. I enjoyed the, it's quite easy to maintain this style. And then, you know, eventually I realised that I don't need to be going to the barbers every week and a half or 2 weeks. I can just do this myself at
home. You're focusing on the positives.
And then I was focusing on the positives, And then, you know, after the first few attempts of shaving my own head, you know, it was quite a sore process, but I've gotten very used to that now. And I did find that after a while, like my confidence came back, and because I'd spent so long trying to hide myself and not liking the way I looked. And then I realized, oh, actually, I much prefer it this way because I'm not hiding anymore. And I've taken control of it. You know, there are days when I do look in the mirror, and it's probably just during the winter, I'm cold. You know, I wear hats now not to hide my head. It's just, you know, to either shield it from the sun or practicality in the winter. But I eventually started to actually love my look. And I can't imagine what it would be like now to have hair. And my parents had said to me before, you know, I remember my dad sitting down with me and him saying, I can help you out. Like he had lost his hair when he was in his early 20s as well. And he had offered to help me out because he was saying that, you know, there are things you can do now. There's you know, you can go for the transplant, you can go for surgery. Yes. I can help you out if you want to do that. I just never really wanted to do that. I wasn't really comfortable. I hadn't got the funds, but also even if someone was to lend it to me, I just didn't really feel comfortable spending that money on myself. I don't know why. That's another question, I suppose. I just just decided, no, I'm just going to shave it. And that's no judgment. I think it's great that guys can do that now and more men are talking about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the reason why I started talking about it more recently, was because for whatever reason, I'm starting to see an awful lot of ads around the place for hair restoration products mm-hmm. or surgery. And I do think it's important that those conversations are happening mm-hmm. because, again, like it's only 10, 11 years ago, but when I was struggling with it, nobody was talking about it.
Yeah. And we have seen people come out even in the public eye since and they're talking about whether it's hair transplants or confidence.
Yeah.
And I suppose one of the things that struck me, because I was taking a look myself before I knew we were going to be chatting, is mm-hmm. that, you know, everywhere you look, there seems to be inverted commas solutions, you know, like, that almost like it's a problem that needs fixing. Yeah. And that creates a narrative then. Maybe there's somebody out there that's experienced or maybe it's in the early days of what you've gone through. And I mean, that's the wrong type of narrative. If somebody wants to take control and get a hair transplant, brilliant, but it shouldn't be seen as a problem.
Yeah, that's the thing that always bothers me, that hair loss is a problem that requires fixing. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. But again, I think it's great that guys can, you know, if you can afford it and you don't mind and you have the funds and you don't mind the fuss, like, go for it in terms of surgery, but and also in terms of shaving it. That's not, you know, just it's a different look. It's not a problem that you're mm-hmm. fixing. You're just going for a different look. You're kind of taking back control. I hate that, you know, a lot of advertisements like the ones I mentioned, it's always like, you know, this is the end of the world and we've got the problem for you. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah. It feels like it for a while. Yeah, we have those kind of solutions that are always out there for every health and beauty fix. Yeah. You know, going through what you have done mm-hmm. and having learned what you have over the last number of years, what would you say to somebody right now that's listening that might be at the early stages of what you've gone through?
Like what I said a minute ago, it's not the end of the world. It mm-hmm. definitely feels like it. And I'm not going to tell people to not feel bad about it, because the only people that actually say that think that it's not a problem are the ones that aren't affected by it mm-hmm. or that it wasn't, you know, something to worry about are the ones that aren't affected by it. But what I will say is it will get better. Take control of it yourself rather than worrying about it. You know, don't do what I did. Like, I would go around, I'd pat the area on my head repeatedly mm-hmm. all the time while I was working or while I was watching a film or anything, and as if I thought that patting it was going to mm-hmm. make it grow back. And I just went around just hunched over and just mm-hmm. embarrassed and almost like, I just felt ugly. And I would just like to say, like, if anyone's feeling like that, you're not ugly. Don't be embarrassed about it. If you think that it will make things better by taking control of it and shaving it, do that. Mm. If anyone ever says to you, if anyone ever makes a jokey comment, actually ask them, why do you think that's funny? Mm-hmm. And if they say it's only a joke, well, then just say it's be funnier, because you would not do that with someone else. You wouldn't pass comment on their appearance. I'd like to think you wouldn't. And I like to think I wouldn't. Bald is beautiful, you know, and I'm going to believe that. I don't know who said that, but I've decided that I'm going to believe that.
Yeah, well, Chris, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your story and for being so honest about it. And, you know, even the idea of working on your confidence, everybody deserves to feel confident in their own skin, however they look.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that, you know, you have come out and spoken about it. I'm sure there's lots of people listening that have taken so much from it. So thank you so much for coming
Thanks
and
for
chatting
me.
With us. I'm joined now by a man who Phil Coulter once described as the most exciting vocal find in Ireland, while the late Ronnie Drew said he had a voice beyond his years. Like, imagine that being said about you. And he's now taken to the stage as Jack O'Brien in Gary Brown's Dockers in Liberty Hall later this month. It is, of course, the one and only George Murphy. George, we were just chatting about your time in Eurostar and you reminded me it was 21 years ago. Now I feel kind of old because I'm thinking, I remember that. You sitting on that stool singing Raglan Road like it was only yesterday, and now here we are.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been that long. Yeah, it's nice to be coming in talking about something different as well mm-hmm. because I've been in so many times talking mm-hmm. about the music, but to be coming in talking about a play and flexing my acting wings at long last.
Well, I can't wait to chat with you about that. Before though we get to Dockers, you've just finished a tour with the Rising Suns. Tell us how that went.
Yeah, it was brilliant. So I mean, the Rising Suns all kind of started in the corner of my local pub.
Wow.
And yeah, so it's a session, you know. Joey's on the bass. He's a grandfather in his 70s, and Tommy is a painter and decorator in his 50s. And then we have school teachers, Declan and Dave on whistles and mandolin and guitar. Jimmy on the banjo is like an electrician, and Shane is who's our percussionist. He works as a God, what does Shane do? He's
talented no matter what he does. Yeah, right?
No, but they all come from different walks of life. Shane is a carpenter, sorry, but they all come from different walks of life. And I sat down with Pat Egan and I said I wanted to take this 8-piece band out on the road. And he just said, look, you're never going to make any money. There's too many mouths to feed. He says, but if you want to go and do it, go and do it. And it's just gone from strength to strength. We started off in small rooms playing to like 100 people. And then we've sold out Vicar Street recently and the Cork Opera House and Millennium Forum. So it's really starting to gather momentum.
And you're already going back to the crowds, the same places next year.
Yeah, we've been
demand.
Asked to go back and play Vicar Street and the Cork Opera House again and Wexford Opera House and the Millennium Forum.
There's no greater compliment than being asked back after you've just played. And of course, you had your album as well that was released in February.
Yeah, well, we set a goal for ourselves, myself and the band, that, you know, one day we might release an album and we might play Vicar Street.
Yeah,
and,
wow.
You know, when we set that goal for ourselves, we kind of thought this is pie in the sky stuff. Like, we're never actually really going to get there, but we were better off aiming for the stars. And if we landed on the moon, then happy days, you know.
Yeah.
But as luck would have it, people got behind us. We built up a big audience and we've managed to, you know, fulfill those ambitions and you know, get on stage at Vicar Street, sell it out and release a studio album. So, yeah, I mean, long may it continue, Anna. Fingers crossed.
Well, you're going from the stage at Vicar Street now to a different kind of stage. Jack O'Dunn, you can get into character there as I'm chatting with you. The play Dockers. Like, how would you describe it? Without giving too much away, you know, tell people a little bit of what it's about.
Well, I sat down with Gary Brown, who's the writer, and he approached me with this idea that he had for Dockers. And it tells the story from Jack O'Dunn's point of view of, you know, working down on Dublin's docks and when the containerization came in, how, you know, dockers and workers down on the docklands were going to become a thing of the past. And it was very much, you know, a change for the docklands community. And, you know, the writing was on the wall for these people that they were no longer going to be, they'd be superfluous, you know. So they were going to be left behind by what was to come. And so Jacko, not wanting to... you know, not be able to earn a book, he decided to teach himself how to play the guitar and write songs about his experiences on the docks and the life that he lived and the life that his ancestors and families and stuff lived. So it's kind of told from the point of view of a Dublin docker who taught himself how to play the guitar and write some songs.
So it's almost like, you know, it's nearly like a musical then, but it's also like a historical narrative of Dublin docks, because I suppose like the culture, the traditions, you know, Dublin Port, it played such a massive part and in the Dublin that's nearly there today. Like, that was the start of it all. So for you to be involved in that, like, you know, describe to us what that feels like.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so much of the history there that I didn't even realise until I sat down and read the script and went through it with Gary and stuff. And it started off, it was supposed to be a one-man play. But they had this idea that I'd come into the pub and, you know, they were thinking then, well, if I'm going to be in a pub, there has to be somebody serving me pints and, you know, somebody to bounce off. So they brought in the brilliant Tara Howley. She's a multi-instrumentalist from Clare. And she's playing my younger cousin, you know. So I'm bouncing off her in it and she's kind of, you know, arguing with me and bickering with me like families do. But it's just cool seeing it come to life and seeing, you know, this history of Dublin and the city that it's become. It would never have happened without the River Liffey and without the trade that went on down in Dublin's docks over the years. And, you know, learning about that history and that culture and trying to imagine myself as one of those people and become a character from that time. It's really interesting.
Like, as well as music, and might I say, like even songs by Damien Dempsey. My husband's a massive fan of Damien Dempsey, so he'll be delighted to hear that. But I suppose Dockers includes many stories of the docks as well. So can you share maybe, you know, any of those stories?
Yeah, well, one of the ones that kind of fascinated me was that, you know, before the Dockers came along, there were other people called hobblers, and they were kind of like the first real dockers. So they used to wait out in the bay in like 5-man skiffs, and like skiffs were like little boats, and like it could be family against family, brother against brother.
Like a race.
Yeah. So as soon as they'd see like a ship coming in on the horizon, they'd go. And the first first ones to get there and put their hook onto the ship, they kind of earned the prize of guiding the ship back into the bay. I'm literally, and for those that are listening that were at the rehearsals today, I'm quoting word for word some of the parts that are in it. But yeah, no, they earned the prize of bringing the ship back into the bay, and then it was theirs to unload, you know. But some of the men were drowned out in Dublin Bay and stuff like that, the hobblers, you know. So it was a dangerous job. It was a dirty, hard labouring job. But there was a lot of camaraderie, a lot of friendships and family orientated things going on, especially with finishing the shifts and then straight into the pubs and all of that kind of thing. And that's what we're trying to capture with it, is the life of a docker, but also the comedy and the funny side of it, as well as the very serious nature of what.
So you've got like the hard, the poignant, you know, they need the soulful, but also the wit and the crack as well. I actually saw even decorating the mahogany, is that with putting the money on the bar countertop. I mean, even those turns of phrase are just superb.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what, there's a song titled Decorate the Mahogany. So that meant to take your money out and put it up on the bar counter and call in an order. You know, and it's great. And I sat today with I'll give Joe O'Bourne a shout out. He's our director, but he's really putting myself and Tara through our paces, you know, saying, no, that's not how they would have said it. They would have said it a bit more like this, they would have done it a bit more like that. So getting into character and trying to become these people and you know, honour them the way they deserve to be honoured. That's the important part we're trying to capture, you know.
And this isn't your first appearance on stage. So you were on stage in the Abbey Theatre. I mean, like the national stage with, you know, highly regarded actors. Did that whet your appetite for it? Like, you were always kind of destined to move towards drama, weren't you?
Yeah, well, when I finished school, I enrolled in an acting college, and I always wanted to pursue acting as a career. It's been one of my passions. But as luck would have it, music kind of fell into my lap, and you know, for the last 20 years now, I've been blessed that I've been able to kind of play music to pay the bills. But I always felt like it was an itch that went unscratched by not kind of pursuing the acting end of things. And I've had a couple of opportunities over the last couple of years with that play in the Abbey and a couple of movies that I done small cameo appearances in and stuff. But this is the first time where, like, being the main role in something, and
the star of the show, George, is what.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, for one,
I can say that if you don't want to.
Yeah, well, it's intimidating. I am scared about it, but like, and I'm nervous about it. But the nerves come from a good place. It's exciting and it's cool to be a part of. And I'm very flattered that Gary asked me to be a part of something. And like you said, with Damien Dempsey's songs and Joe O'Byrne's directing and Tara Howley's brilliant musicality, it's just a very worthwhile thing to be a part of.
And of course, you provide some of your own songwriting as well to tell the story.
Yeah, well, that was something I was, you know, hugely, that really whet my appetite to get involved in. It was that, you know, Damo had put into it as much as he could put in before other obligations came along for him. So it hit a little bit of a full stop for a while for Gary, and he was looking to take it on to the next level. And when he approached me about it and told me that I'd have the opportunity to kind of nearly co-write with Damien and with Gary and come up with these ideas, that was definitely something that, you know, I wanted to put my name to.
Certainly,
you know,
a draw to the play.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you mentioned nerves, you know, and for a lot of people listening in all different walks of life, you know, they struggle with nerves. How do you combat nerves? Is it the same for when you play music as now that you're on stage, or are they different? Like, and, you know, do they change?
Maybe initially, but it's weird because I haven't been overly nervous about a performance at a gig for a long time, because I kind of know it like the back of my hand now. Yeah. And I've learned all of these songs and I know them in my sleep, but I don't know Jack O'Dunn yet. Okay. I don't know how I'm going to deliver and portray this man just yet. And, you know, that's, I suppose, where the nerves do come in, because I don't want to be stood on the stage and be like, oh God, what's the next line? What's the next thing you're supposed to say? And it's those kind of things that, you know, you nearly want the ground to swallow you up. But I'm confident that as long as we put the hard work in for the next couple of weeks, we will get there, you know.
I have absolutely no doubt about it. It's the Friday, the 13th of September, Liberty Hall Theatre. Tickets are on sale now. Before you go, can I ask, will there be more dates?
There will have to be, because it's sold out.
Oh, well, there you go now.
They're currently discussing adding more dates now in early next year, January, February, March.
Well, aren't I glad I asked the questions? Well, there you go. We'll have to keep an eye out for those, George Murphy. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. And may I say, the hot seat really suits you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I'm sure the stage really suits you as well. I can't wait to see you in action. Thank you so much for coming in. So if there was any one thing that defined this weekend, I think it's fair to say that it's been music. So whether you were maybe cashing in the Karma, queuing for tickets for you know who, or maybe you were singing your heart out in Croke Park, it was all about the music. And you know what? We may as well keep that trend going here. And direct from the RTÉ Radio 1 recommends list is Cork musician John Blake. And he's in studio now. John,
hello.
Delighted. Cork man, how are you keeping today?
Very good. All well, yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, what I'd love to do before we chat is get you straight into your first song, Easy Now. It's an original and a new single. So in your own time, take it away.
Thank you.
Laying on the concrete, wishing I was stronger. Back when I was 17, mind was always racing, feet were always pacing, blind behind a thick smoke screen. Just because I'm getting older doesn't mean I'm dying. Drop, I'm drinking, trying to pull me under. I thought it'd set me free. Just because I'm getting older doesn't mean I'm dying. It's easy now to find some peace of mind. Gonna stop it, couldn't if I wanted, buried by the turning tide, held it like the sand kept slipping through my hands. I'm following the fading light, just because I'm getting older doesn't mean I'm dying.
Your backup singer, I'm just swaying here beside you.
You're hired.
Well done. Cheer up. Your upcoming album is going to be released on Friday. So congratulations. Yeah. Can you tell people, I suppose, what was the inspiration behind it?
Well, I suppose that song that I just played there, Easy Now, is kind of a nice synopsis of the theme of the album, in a sense, in that I'm 37 years of age now, and I'm kind of coming to a big change in my life where my wife and I are expecting our first child.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. In November. So this record for me is kind of a line in the sand, so to speak. And it's
next chapter.
Exactly. It's me kind of looking back and kind of purging all those thoughts and memories that perhaps I want to let go over those embarrassments and kind of from my late teens through to, I suppose, last week.
We know, all have those, yeah, even yesterday.
So it's really just that sort of a process.
So it's almost like autobiographical.
It's the whole thing is, in for the first time ever, and this has sounded quite strange to a lot of people, but for the first time ever, it's the first entirely autobiographical album that I've released. Often I would have written songs that would be stories about particular characters or people that I'd met, you know, that kind of thing. But this really is heart on sleeve stuff, for better or for worse.
And for you then, I suppose, like that being so honest and it's a reflection of your life and where you are in your life, does it feel quite vulnerable, or are you like, you know what, sometimes the truest and the most powerful music comes from actually real life and being raw?
Very much so. I mean, to be honest, when you stand on a stage, or when I will stand on a stage and sing these songs, I have a feeling that there's going to be a real sense of conviction. Rather than sort of playing the role of a character, it's entirely sincere. And I mean, it always is, insofar as I can do so. But I think it'll be next level stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I think the title of your second track, the cover that you're going to sing now, The Times They Are A-Changin' by Bob Dylan, is definitely applicable for your scenario and a lot of other people's scenarios. So in your own time, take it away.
Yeah.
Come gather round people wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If this time to you is worth saving, you'd better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. Now the times, they are a-changin'. So come senators and congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he who gets hurt will be he who has stalled. And the battle outside is raging. It'll soon shake the window and rattle the walls. Of the times, they are a-changin'. And come writers and critics who prophesize with their pens, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon while the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling a who that it's naming. For the losers now, later will win. Now the times, they are a-changin'. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, you can't criticize what you can understand. And your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. And the old road is rapidly aging. Please get out a new one if you can't lend a hand. At the times, they are a-changin'. Well, the line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, just as present now will later be past. and the order is rapidly changing. Please get out a new one if you can lend a hand. The times, they are a-changing.
John Black, thank you so much for coming in. The very best of luck with your new album, Cheer Up. It's going to be released on Friday. It is available to pre-order now at johnbleck.com. You can also find all of his tour dates there as well. Very best of luck with the new arrival as well. Make sure you get all the late nights in now before the real late nights start. Yeah. Our consumer champion, Conor Pope, is back in studio because we all know you love having him sort out the problems. And of course, if there's any issues that you think only Conor could solve, you can email us on pricewatch@rte.ie. Conor, we're going to be talking about health insurance.
Okay.
And I suppose for a lot of people, it's kind of something that they either have or are thinking about or don't have and they should have. But today's problem, right, first, my parents have had health insurance for years and took my dad off the policy at the last renewal because he had to go into a nursing home. My mother has recently gone into full-time nursing home care and doesn't need insurance anymore. But when I rang today to cancel, I was told that moving to a nursing home was not an acceptable reason and that she shouldn't cancel until the 12-month policy duration has elapsed. When I asked again what were considered acceptable reasons, I was told that changing job or moving country were some examples. How can that be fair? What's your thoughts?
On the surface, it doesn't look very fair at all, right? Because you'd argue that someone moving to Australia for a year is far less serious a change in your life as someone moving into a nursing home. And this person's argument was that, well, she's going to be moving into a nursing home. She's going to be cared for in that nursing home, so all of her medical needs are going to be taken care of, so I don't need my health insurance. But there are certain rules in place when it comes to health insurance, and they're very strict, and they're rules that are imposed by all of the companies. So there's three big providers in the country, there's soon to be a fourth, and they're imposed by all of the big companies, and there's reasons for those rules to be in place. And one of the strict rules is that if you take out a health insurance policy on the 1st of February, you have to pay for that policy for 12 months. And what the insurance companies do, what they do is, it's almost like you say, I'm going to take out a health insurance policy and I'm going to pay 200 euros a month into that policy. So that's 2,400 euros. So what the health insurance company kind of does is they say, they put the 2,400 euros into the bank, and then you pay them off over the period of 12 months. So you're paying in installments for something that they might have paid for up front. So that's one reason. But the other reason is just to ensure that the market has a degree of consistency, because otherwise you might have people cancelling for all sorts of reasons throughout the course of the year. So all of the companies impose these rules. And I spoke to a number of different people in the industry this morning, and they all say moving into a nursing home isn't a reason why you're allowed to cancel a health insurance policy, for the very simple reason that a lot of people who move into nursing homes want to maintain their private health insurance because it gives them options when it comes to treatment. Because if you lose your private health insurance and you are, let's say, in a nursing home, or you're in another circumstance where you don't have health insurance, you are kind of, you have only access to the public system. So you don't have access to the private system. So the rules are there in place, and there's very little by way of flexibility. Now, when it comes to leaving the country, or if you know, for financial hardship or whatever it might be, the companies have been mandated to show a degree of flexibility. But this is not one of those circumstances. And while I actually did speak to the company involved, and they said that they would, you know, there was nothing really they could do, but the person can lodge an appeal, and, you know, they will listen to the circumstances of the appeal, because it might be that there are other extenuating circumstances. For instance, the person might be struggling to pay the costs, or so there might be extenuating circumstances. And it's not a question that the companies are really out to get you, but there are these rules in place, and they kind of fairly rigidly stick to them.
Yeah, so it's not as clean cut as you might think. Let's stick with health insurance for a second. And I suppose the big question, like, personally, I'm asking it right now as well in my head, is like, how do you know if you're on the best plan?
Well, it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of people don't have health insurance. Around half the country don't have health insurance at all. And for those people, you know, it's fine, because I think it's always worth pointing out that you're not, like, it's, we're not, we don't live in the United States, mm-hmm. where health insurance is absolutely critical, or else you could find yourself just left on the side of the road. Because if you're in a car accident, heaven forbid, or if you have a serious medical condition like a heart attack or a stroke or whatever, you're brought in through the public system and you're treated by the public system. And the public health system in Ireland gets a very hard rap. And there's a lot of negative news stories about it. And sometimes it's incredibly difficult for the people who are working in it and for their patients. But the public health staff, doctors, nurses, the admin staff, they do a really good job. And the public healthcare system is quite good. But the reason why private health insurance can be important is it allows you access to a lot of outpatient care, a lot of elective care. And the waiting lists for elective care in this country are shocking. Like, everybody knows that. So it allows you to do without those lists. How you know if you're paying too much? There's a very simple rule of thumb. If you've had the same health insurance policy for more than 3 years, chances are you're paying over the odds. And the reason for that is, when I was a kid in the 1980s, my dad had health insurance for us. And there was basically one company with five different policies. There was Plan A, Plan B, Plan C, Plan D, Plan E. And everybody had Plan B, mm-hmm. except like the super wealthy who might have had Plan D. But that was it. It was really simple. Now there's more than 300 different policies on the market. God. And they're all called things like, some of them are called Family Friendly Plus. And You're Amazing ABC. And then some of them are called P9117241. So like, it's incredibly complicated. But one of the things that the companies do is they roll out new plans to attract new business, and those plans are better value than the old legacy plans that they have. So if you're on a plan that's more than 3 or 4 or 5 years old, it might be less, it might be bad value compared to one of the newer plans that they've rolled out. So it's always important to just check the timing of it. And that's the first rule of thumb. And then, so once you've done that, well, then there are other steps that you might want to jump, or other hoops you might want to jump through to make sure you're getting good value for money.
Let's talk about like the idea of taking out like a small excess on your policy and how that can actually save you money.
It's actually phenomenal, the differences that can make. So, and I'm not talking about taking out big excesses, because people don't want to do that, because one of the reasons why so few people in Ireland change health insurance provider, and more than 70% of people don't change. So they're the people who I'm kind of talking to in this instance. They're all with the same company. And one of the reasons why is people are afraid. And I totally get that. The area is complicated. You're literally sometimes dealing with matters of life and death and your health, and you don't want to be messing around. And you kind of think, okay, well, X company has been good to me for all these years. I don't want to leave them and join Y company and it might all go pear-shaped or whatever it might be. So in terms of taking out excess, people can be afraid. But let's say you're paying $3,000 a year for your health insurance, and you agree to, now I'm not speaking in specifics here, but you say, I'm going to take on an excess whereby I'll pay €100 every time I have to stay in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not every night I have to stay in hospital. It's just if I have to go in for 1 day or 3 days or 10 days, I'm going to pay an excess of €100. By taking on that simple excess, you can save yourself a couple of €100 a year on your health insurance. And if there's a couple involved, well, then you're looking at 250, 300, 500 euros a year. And it's by kind of looking at ways that you can do that without dramatically impacting the level of cover that you have.
And like, even the fact, so it's like you're willing to pay a bit extra, but actually you're saving much more money.
And that's only if you have to go into hospital, remember, because a lot of the time you won't have to go into hospital, so the excess is irrelevant.
So let's talk then about, I suppose, the idea of comparing policies. How do people do that?
Now, one of the things to remember is that most people's health insurance comes up for renewal in January, February or March. They're the key months. So people should be thinking about it now if they're anxious to save themselves a few bob. So the first and simplest thing that you do is you ring your existing health insurance provider.
Ring, because a lot of people will go online.
And I can't stress enough, I don't think that's a good idea when it comes to health insurance, because by going online and filling out forms, the companies love you to do that.
You're pushed on.
Companies love you to do that. But the reason why it's not such a good idea with health insurance is if I go online and try and do all that stuff online, the responsibility of getting everything right falls on my shoulders.
Okay.
If I'm on the phone talking to the staff of a health insurance provider, the responsibility is on them to give me the right information. And believe me, there is no stupid question when it comes to talking to health insurance providers. So don't be bamboozled. Don't be confused. Don't let them say, sure, if you go onto our website now, you'll be able to find out all that information. Make them explain it to you carefully. And the first thing you do is you ring your existing provider and you say, do you have any plans that are comparable to mine that are cheaper? And make them answer that question. And then if they say, well, we have this plan, but it's not as good, or we've that plan that's not as good. And then you say to them, okay, well, you have my medical records. you know all the claims I've made in the last 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. Would all of the things that I've claimed for in the last 2 years be covered under this cheaper plan?
Clever.
And if the answer is yes, well, then it's a no-brainer. You just move to the cheaper plan. And once you're armed with the information and you've a couple of different policy names with your existing provider, you ring the other two companies on the market and you say, how do these compare and what can you do for me? And the companies want your business, but they can't lie to you. They can't tell you things that aren't true just to get your business. So by asking those questions, and the question that I know Ray he loves the question is, and the question is very simple, do you have any plans on your books that are comparable to the one that I have, and are they cheaper? And once you ask that question, you kind of put it up to them.
Answer. A question about people themselves and their children being on the same policy.
It's not. And the reason why is because we don't have any private hospitals in Ireland for children. There's lots of private hospitals for adults. And it's this kind of counterintuitive thing. Your children should have worse cover in many ways than you do. And the reason for that is because what you want healthcare for your, or health cover for your child to cover, are outpatient care and things like that. And once you have that, you should be in a good place. But you shouldn't worry about private rooms and private hospitals or all that other stuff.
Thank you so much, Conor Pope, for coming in. Of course, if you have any issues that you think Conor can help with, pricewatch@rte.ie.